Hi, I'm Anne McElhenney.
And I'm Phelan McAleer.
Welcome to the Anne and Phelan Scoop. It is week 60. That's 1 year and 2 months since the 2 weeks to flatten the curve lockdown.
Yes.
So what are we doing today in the podcast film?
In our double masking world, we are looking at Hunter Biden's Chinese takeaway.
Oh, boom, boom.
And like all Chinese food, it always left them wanting more. Boom, boom. And of course, it's all about the children.
Don't forget, it's all about the children.
Yeah.
And we're going to be speaking to the opinion editor of the New York Post.
A very, very interesting interview coming up, actually.
About his new book.
Yeah, and how, you know, it's about how we abandon tradition at our peril. And of course, I'm sure we'll be discussing the big, how big tech and big media suppressed the aforementioned Joe Biden corruption scandal before the last election. So that's going to be a great interview. What else we got, Anne?
We have a story about the cats.
Who's a pussy?
Quite an extraordinary story about the cats, which you will not want to miss. And a lot of people have asked a lot about the cats, by the way. I don't think they're visible right now. But anyway, we won't spoil. That's an incredible story. Yeah,
let's just talk about a brush with death. And we're left to pick up the pieces.
We are.
And they were expensive pieces.
I was going to say, we're picking up the pieces and the check.
Pieces of gold, pieces of silver.
Yes.
And crazy California is too crazy, even for Crocodile Dundee.
Bum bum.
And actually, it's not. Unfortunately, it's not crazy California. It's crazy our back door. Anyway, well, come on.
And we have a Prohibition cocktail, which I shook up earlier, that you won't want to miss either. Really great. Really great cocktail. Highly recommend. Quite alcohol forward. Just reminding people of that. Funny, I read something about it, about how much proof it is, this cocktail. And I was realising, you definitely couldn't have two. Like that kind of way, right?
It's not quite Long Island iced tea, but it's up there.
It's right up there. Phelan was on hand, just in case I need medical attention. It's not quite like that. It's actually very nice. I would recommend
remember
it. I'm giving the wrong impression.
Remember
there.
The time Paddy McAleer bought me a Long Island iced tea? I was buzzing.
I was with you there for that.
Yes.
Because I don't even know, did they make them anymore? But Irish people loved the idea of a Long Island iced tea. It was like, you know, showing their fortitude that they could drink basically every white, every clear alcohol all mixed together with some Coca-Cola. Desperate stuff.
Yes.
Awful.
Yes.
Okay, starting with some...
Hunter Biden.
Latest Hunter Biden news.
Hunter Biden's doggy news. Hunter Biden, according to emails that have surfaced in the Daily Mail, Hunter Biden had a very, very, very interesting relationship with his Chinese-American secretary,
mm-hmm.
who worked with him when he partnered, and as the Daily Mail said, and this is in quotes, the spy chief of China. And those quotes, the quote is not from some scurrilous journalist. That is a quote from Hunter Biden himself, the spy chief of China. He called his business partner, who arranged this arrangement with him for the secretary. He called the boss, his business partner, the spy chief of China.
Nice.
So that's who the president's son was involved in. So yeah, the Daily Mail revealed these messages, and in an audio recording, it's with his business venture with Patrick Ho. And Hunter, after Ho was arrested, he described Ho to her friend as the spy chief of China. And she worked with him during, this lady, Ji Kui Bao, she worked for Hunter during his partnership with Chinese oil giant CEFC in a multi-million dollar deal. She did the normal stuff that a secretary should do, schedule flights, etc. Then she started sending him advice on how Joe could win the election.
Multi-talented
and
lady.
And opposition research, etc. Okay. I wonder who was providing her with that.
Hmm.
I wonder, would there have been any kind of foreign interference, any spy chiefs in China giving her stuff to send to him? And I wonder how close they got, because she ended up, if you look at all the pictures of Hunter in his various poses and various, because he's always wearing these dog tags, and I assume they're the dog tags of his brother Bo, and somehow these dog tags were taken off him and ended up in her apartment, and she's very keen to return them. And then she also, she really got into the Biden way of doing things, as the when his business partner Patrick Ho was arrested by the FBI and convicted of bribery, and then Hunter said he's the spy chief. She says, look, all that money is left in that company. It's going to be dissolved now anyway. Why don't you basically raid the coffers? No one's going to care. He's in jail. You know, you may as well, you know. And then she encouraged him to put personal expenses through the business. So, you know, this is why we're making the Hunter Biden movie, actually. It's because this kind of stuff went on. Is still going on.
And the mainstream media are very incurious about it.
Actually, the opposite. They're suppressing it.
Yeah.
You know, they went from incurious to suppression. So It's a scandal. This is why we're making the movie, the Hunter Biden movie. We're very close to having a finalized script.
Go to mysonhunter.com and give what you can.
Yes.
We appreciate it, and we appreciate all of you who have already donated. Thank
actually,
you.
And I would like to put up on the screen now that the Daily Mail have authenticated the laptop. They sent it off to an authentication company, and they've gone to enormous lengths to prove that what they are publishing is correct. Why the New York Times? Why other
Sorry,
people?
Sorry, who sent it away for authentication?
The Daily Mail.
Oh, the Daily Mail.
And
okay.
paid for it. And by the way, this is what the Planned Parenthood did with David DeLayden's tapes. They sent it away to get authenticated. And
I bet they didn't like the answer they
well,
got.
Well, no, Fusion GPS, that wonderful organization, said there were definite questions to be asked. Right, and one of the questions was that the tapes would cut off every so often. You don't, and it was basically when David was going to the bathroom, and that was very clear. He was heading towards the bathroom, and then he says, "Well, there's this place here where David says this guy says it's an arm, and it's unintelligible. You're not quite sure what he said." Well, my point was, why don't you go and ask him, the guy, and you'll find that's what he actually said. And David was there, so he knows what he said, so he filled in that gap. So. Listen, this is properly authenticated, and this authentication is available to anyone. These tips are real. These emails are real. We're going to be almost doing them verbatim in our movie, mysonhunter.com. So please go give what you can, mysonhunter.com, and help us get the truth out there.
So just in my continuing efforts to read the Hunter Biden book so you don't have to.
Yes, God help you.
two little tiny extracts I want to read from today. And it's kind of amazing. It's just amazing the way he writes about things. So let's have a listen to this piece. After the funeral, so he's talking about the funeral of his brother. After the funeral, his brother Bo. After the funeral, Haley showed me a deep sense of compassion in making certain I took care of Bo's memory as he would have wished. Most notably by helping her start, wait for it. That's me, by the way, saying wait for it. Helping her start the Bo Biden Foundation for the Protection of Children. She also allowed me to be there for Natalie and little Hunter, just as Bo wanted.
Can I just say something? this is a guy, you know, there's emails on there. His own sister or his aunt didn't want him anywhere near her children because he was taking drugs and looking at pornography. But he started the Bo Biden. I love that. I love that. Well, she showed him enormous compassion.
She showed a deep sense of compassion.
I think
that's not the word that, as my mother would say, that wouldn't be the words I'd use to describe it now. What she showed him.
Yes.
Let's be honest now.
That's by his own admission.
And then he
showed him a bit more than the compassion now. Must be a new word, a new more the young people use now for that kind of thing.
I hate that accent, can I just say? Because it doesn't sound like anybody I've ever met. Never mind even my mother. So hang on a minute.
I'm from the north, I can't do you southerners.
So chapter 5, then again, he mentions this, and I just want to mention this again. Chapter 5, he says, you know, the first weeks after Bo's burial, and by the way, he mentions his brother's death enormously, but I would say, which I don't really fault him using his brother's death and using his brother's memory in the way that he uses it in this book. I think it's really shameless. I was committed to the idea, but listen to this. I was committed to the idea of building on my brother's legacy. I sat down with Aunt Val, Hallie, and Patty Lewis, who worked closely with Bo as a deputy attorney general, and together we started the Bo Biden Foundation for the Protection of Children. The non-profit was an outgrowth of Bo's work fighting child abuse as attorney general and now has programs in 20 states. I bring up the Bo Biden Foundation for the Protection of Children only for the case of just mentioning just how shameless people are, how, like, it's extraordinary. He can write about this. He can set up a foundation for the protection of children while he denies the existence of a child that is his own. Completely denies the existence of that child. Has never met his own child. Don't talk to us, Hunter Biden, about child abuse. Like, child abuse. This is the definition of child abuse, by the way. You're the definition of child abuse. And to be proudly flaunting this Bo Biden Foundation for the Protection of Children while you have ghosted, isn't that the right phrase? You've ghosted your own child. You're the present president of the United States, Joe Biden, is doing the very same thing. And I just think the gall of you, like the neck of you, like the shamelessness to do that while you are in essence, child abuse, ignoring the existence of a child. It's horrific. Anyway, I thought I'd bring those two little pieces to your memory. From that awful spot.
From that chaos.
And that chaos.
We want to go over now to our interview with Sohrab Ammari, who's the op-ed editor for the New York Post. And he's written a book. He'll explain it better than I ever can. So let's go over to that interview now that we did earlier. Hello. And now we go to our interview with Sohrab Ammari, the op-ed editor for the New York Post. He's written a very, very timely book, The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in the Age of Chaos. Welcome to the show, Sohrab.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so thanks for coming on.
Great book, by the way. Thank you so much.
To give our listeners some idea of who you are, and you were born in Iran to, I suppose, what would be called a progressive Shiite family. Your father was an architect and your mother was an artist, is that correct?
Correct.
And your family fled the Ayatollahs, the theocratic and repressive Ayatollahs in Iran. And when you came to America, I think it's clear you embraced the freedom and progress that America embodied to you and probably to your family. Moving fast forward, you later converted to Catholicism. And it's the physical journey to America and your religious journey to America, I think, that led you to write this book. And just so that people know what it's called The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. So yeah, it was both a spiritual journey, a religious journey, not to use that word spiritual, because we'll talk about that later too.
Yes.
A religious journey, but also a physical journey coming to America. First of all, I think I should declare an interest. There's a passage in the book about your life where you say you're the member of the global creative class, free to move anywhere, work anywhere, party anywhere, live in midtown Manhattan, close to a Whole Foods, close to restaurants that serve every cuisine on earth, edit the op-ed pages of a major tabloid, get invited to all the media shindigs. You are basically living my life.
The dream, the life he dreamt of that hasn't happened yet.
Yes.
Well, but the whole book is about the discontents of that.
Yes,
life.
Exactly.
I feel a little bit better that you're actually discontented with, because perhaps I would be discontented with that life. But that is true, actually. And that passage struck me both as, and that was my ideal life, but also you say this is not your ideal life. And there's a very, very interesting interest in the introduction when you talk about you're imagining your son aged 47. And his life, and to all intents and purposes, it looks like the perfect life, and you've been the perfect father. But you point out what the pitfalls that could be behind that perfect life. So we'll start off by.
Well, first of all, I mean, you sent us a copy of the book, I think, on Friday, and I basically wanted to sort of say you kind of ruined my weekend because because sometimes we have people on who've written books, and it's like, oh, you know, but your book was so good that I kept, every time I wasn't reading it, I was regretting whatever it was else that I was doing.
Pleased to hear that. But nevertheless, sorry for eating up your whole weekend.
I highly recommend it to people. And we'll obviously put up all of the context of how to get in touch. But the book, you say that the book is, at the very beginning, you dedicate the book kind of to the two Maxes, to two significant Maxes, Maximilians, who kind of inspired you to write the book and are, whose stories have inspired you to write the book in a way. Let's put it that way. Who are the two Maxes?
Maximilian I, if you will, is Saint Maximilian Kolbe, the great Christian martyr, the saint of Auschwitz, as he's often called. He was a Polish Franciscan friar, lived a remarkable life before World War II. You know, he went on missions to Asia. He started evangelizing through radio and newspaper in a pioneering way, started a whole monastery outside Warsaw called Neopokolonov, or City of the Immaculate Mother of God. He also started a monastery in Nagasaki, Japan, which survived the American atomic bombing. So this is all before his true claim to fame, which is what he did when the Nazis rounded him up and sent him to Auschwitz. The story is famous, but just to briefly recount it, someone escaped from his prison block, and what the Nazis did when that happened was to randomly select 10 men to die of starvation as punishment for the one escapee. And St. Maximilian Kolbe was not one of the 10 picked. Nevertheless, when he heard one of the condemned men cry out, "My wife, my children," he stepped forward from the line and volunteered to take that man's place. And so he was canonized as a martyr in 1982. And so when I heard that story, I had just been received into the Catholic Church myself. And, you know, you take a confirmation and baptismal name, and I picked Augustine for that. So then I had to do something with this other name whom I couldn't kind of exercise out of my mind. Like, once I heard that story, I had to do something with it. So as it happened, my wife and I were expecting our first child, and it was a boy. So we named him after St. Maximilian Kolbe, which leads me to Maximilian II. That would be this Max. He's now 4 years old. When I started writing the book, he was 2. And the book, in a way, is a response to my paternal anxieties about the kind of man that our Western civilization would chisel out of him. And you already both referred to it in the sense that I don't think he'll be like, I doubt likely he'll be like, I don't know, like jobless and addicted to opioids, although that's a real possibility these days. You know, but his parents are, you know, he'll be as kind of a child of the elite. So chances are he'll inherit kind of elite status. But my fear is that he'll just live a life of no moral purpose. You know, he'll just rack up academic and career achievements and never kind of bind himself to anything, not get married, not have children, because all of those things are now seen as encumbrances on the true self, which just wants to keep his options open. And so the book, really, the title of the book is The Unbroken Thread. And without ever explicitly saying it, basically what I'm trying to do is bind my Maximilian to his namesake, but not just to his namesake, but to the traditions on which the Kolbe's sacrifices rested. What made it possible for that man in that moment to lay down his life for a complete stranger at Auschwitz was an entire formation in philosophy, in ideas, in faith, that is under threat these days. It's not easily accessible. So I wrote the book as a kind of project of transmission, because I have to give my son something better than myself. I'm pretty lousy and selfish, and so I want to give him ideas instead, and hence the book, and hence the thread in the title.
I mean, as you say, people know they know the Maximilian Kolbe story. I mean, I know the Maximilian Kolbe story, but I have to say, you brought me to tears just even remembering the sacrifice. Extraordinary. And it reminded me very much, actually, of Bonhoeffer's last moments, actually, because I'd kind of forgotten that bit where they talked about. So people, I mean, the reason we know Maximilian Kolbe's story is that people witnessed it. People were there. People saw it. People lived. And I think, am I correct in saying, would you help me with this memory? Because I feel like I definitely watched his beatification, and it would be John Paul II.
Correct, right?
And
the man he saved was there.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Go on.
Franciszek, I forget his last name, is a Polish man, but he was present at the canonization.
But I really, I felt there was very similarity. Once I read that, I was thinking, God, the similarity between his death and Bonhoeffer's is so extraordinary. I mean, I even wonder how much time there was between those two deaths.
No, you're right. Probably not much.
Not much, you know, but yeah. But very similar as well. Both of them very much at peace when they died.
You mentioned it, but just to let people know, like, the death was not, he wasn't executed. The death of these 10 men, they were starved to death and denied water. So they died a horrible death in like 10 or 12.
Yeah, one of the worst. And again, attested by eyewitnesses, I can't get over this, that the other men, you know, because they're human beings and just have natural reactions, were kind of crying, begging, and that he was never heard to beg or cry. He just said the rosary the whole time. And then that he was the only one fully conscious when the camp authorities came to finish them off. 6 had already died. 4 were alive, but of those 4, 3 were basically in states of unconsciousness, but St. Maximilian was fully awake, as it were, and offered his own arm.
It's just an extraordinary story. God, the times there were people that were living in compared to the times then, in a way.
Yes.
So the book, let's get on to the book, asks 12 questions.
Lots of different things.
Is God reasonable? Why would God want you to take a day off? We'll come back to some of these. What's good about death?
Is sex a private matter?
Yes. One touches on a subject that has long exercised me. Can you be spiritual without being religious?
something like 1 in 5 Americans now identify as spiritual but not religious. And so it's a growing group. And I try to interrogate what that means. Is it possible to be spiritual but not religious? I do that through the life of a pair of anthropologists named Victor and Edie Turner, or Victor and Edith Turner. Brits, you know, post-war, you know, at a time of, they were both very much secularist themselves, and communists, actually, card-carrying communists. And then, but they're anthropologists, and they're interested in ritual, in religious rituals. And why is it that in African societies or many traditional societies, the passage from being a teenager to being an adult is marked by some ritual, whereas in the West, you sort of just, the two blending each of into each other without any sort of real passage. And so they go to Africa and they spend a lot of time with a tribe called the Ndembu that live in South Central Africa. And they just observe their rituals. And they notice that religious ritual does all sorts of things for the community. It resolves intractable conflicts. It reminds the powerful to serve the weak. It kind of introduces a kind of transcendent dimension into what is otherwise a kind of very hard scrabble tribal life. And they're so moved by this. And so realizing that religious ritual is so fundamental to being fully human, that when they return to Britain, they become Catholics. And it's not quite clear why. They've written quite a lot about it, but the bottom line is that they heard the echo of the African drums of what ritual does in terms of introducing this kind of liminal dimension between structured hierarchical society and this deeper other dimension in which all human beings are equal or share a kind of generic human kindness. They heard the echoes of that most clearly when they went to a mass presided over by an Irish priest in Stockton, England. The point that I try to make in that chapter is the problem with spiritual but not religious isn't the religious aspect, because a lot of these people actually do have practices that resemble religion, right? They go to spinning and they work really hard on the bike and then they do yoga. So there's a kind of asceticism and denial and self-discipline, all those things kind of you associate with ritual. What they lack is shared public meanings about the ultimate meaning of life, which is what religion brings into the picture. And so their spirituality fails as spirituality because it doesn't do some of the functions that for traditional peoples like African tribal people or devout Roman Catholics, the functions that ritual plays in making religion a worthwhile human exercise.
I think this is one of the things that I really loved about the book. I think it's one of the great strengths is the stories that you tell. Lots of them, like C.S. Lewis. I didn't actually know that C.S. Lewis's mother died when he was 10. And obviously that had a massive effect on the rest of his life. I really loved that. But actually the other piece that I really liked and thought was a fascinating story that maybe a lot of people don't know about is this commencement address by Solzhenitsyn in 1978 to Harvard. And Solzhenitsyn had been in America, I think he said, for 4 years, had obviously escaped, gotten out of Russia, you know, the author of One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, she says, and The Gulag Archipelago. And so he comes to America, you know, ostensibly everyone would imagine, oh wow, great, he's in free America and all that, and then was as you say in the book, is a very brilliant story that you tell. I just loved it. He wouldn't talk to anyone, he didn't do interviews, would be very reclusive. And then Harvard appealed to him and he decided he would do this commencement address. And as you say, and I looked it up today, we'll show a little piece of that right now, of the rain falling over all these people with their umbrellas out at this commencement address in Harvard. You can see that there. I'm just showing that clip there.
This ascension will be similar to climbing onto the next anthropologic stage. No one on earth has any other way left but upward.
And then he comes on stage, he speaks in Russian, and they have somebody simultaneously translated.
Tell us the story of what happened.
As Solzhenitsyn himself, and by the way, everyone I've talked to about this book, and while I was narrating the audio version, stumbles over how precisely to say it. I sometimes say Solzhenitsyn, sort of pseudo-Russianizing it. And yes. Then, anyway, so let's all relax about
Solzhenitsyn. Yeah, exactly.
He was expected, as he wrote in his diary at the time, and the diaries have only just recently been published, which made it a kind of great resource for me to mine as trying to tell the story anew, that he was expected to sing the immigrant's ode to the great Atlantic fortress of liberty. You know, like, I came from a closed society, a totalitarian dictatorship, and thank God for America. And he didn't do that. He shockingly, scandalously didn't do that. What he did was, he said, obviously, everyone knows how much he detests Soviet communism and what he suffered in the Gulag and at the hands of the KGB and so forth. But the conclusion of his famous Harvard commencement speech, which was titled The World Split Apart, was, if I were asked whether I would recommend your society, such as it exists now, for the transformation of mine, meaning Russia behind the Iron Curtain, I'd have to decline your offer. And so that's very, obviously, very shocking. And the entire Western media turned against them at the time. But now the speech looks prophetic, because what he diagnosed was a failing in Western liberalism, or in American style liberalism, in that it has reduced our common life together just to a matter of rights and legalism, and sort of the selfish drive for, I'm just going to pursue my rights to the maximal degree, and how that impoverishes the individual soul and a society at large, and especially how it fails to distinguish between freedom for the good and freedom for evil. This is a very classic theme in you know, so the classical tradition, Aristotle or Judeo-Christian tradition, broadly speaking, clearly distinguish between freedom for good and license for evil, and saying that the two aren't the same thing. But somehow by the time in the 1970s, he sensed an America in which that distinction wasn't made. What mattered was just maximizing individual rights. And the result was a society in which, paradoxically, true freedom of thought had been extinguished. So, for example, you know, he says, your media have all the rights, you have freedom for the press, but you don't have freedom for the reader, in the sense the media are all owned by large corporations, that they all say the same thing. These narrow corridors of opinion.
How prescient is that?
This
right
was
now?
In the 78s. Imagine today the degree to which all the blue check reporters and editors all just, it's as though they all get the same memo in the morning where they're like, yep, we're going to say this about Russian collusion or whatever. So I think he's been very much vindicated. There's something, it's not that obviously, and he was at the time accused of being a theocrat and a dictator and a would-be autocrat and so forth. It's not. I mean, he knew how bad a lawless kind of tyrannical regime could be, but he just saw that there's a kind of different kind of repression that happens in a liberal society that doesn't have moral foundations. It just, the repression becomes more diffuse, and it's mostly private actors doing it as opposed to like a centralized government, but it's no less degraded for that.
I found the whole thing, the whole Solzhenitsyn story, was incredible. And I also like just the details of the fact that I just love that story of where he went to a friend, right, when he eventually got out of Russia, that he went to stay with a friend, I think, in Switzerland. And every journalist in the world wanted him, and everyone wanted to interview him, whatever. And he was like, look, I had to be really careful because he still had family in Russia. And but there was one journalist who he had a relation. And did you intentionally maybe not mention the names of these people? But there was one journalist who had been really good to him. And he thought, you know what, I'm gonna give an interview to that one guy. But another guy that remained nameless, and I would love to know, are you going to tell
There's
us?
There's no reason, because it was just to the thrust of the story, it didn't matter. It's just
okay. Yeah, actually, you know what? Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So one
we,
other.
As we just wanted the gossip.
But we just wanted the gossip.
So he gave the interview to this reporter who had helped him a lot back in Moscow, where he was still chased by the KGB. As he made an exception for him, and another journalist was so jealous by the fact that this reporter got an interview, that he made up the claim that reporter had brought him secret letters from his wife in Moscow. So that would really endanger his wife, because she was still in the Soviet Union. And it also would endanger the ability of the good reporter, the one who had been granted the interview, to operate as a reporter in the Soviet capital. And so it was just made up, you know, and but the neither the outlet nor the reporter who did it ever kind of apologized or retracted or what
or
have you.
Any, so, or faced any consequences at all.
Yeah. And so nowadays, I mean, again, to not to politicize this question too much, but there's so many instances of that where reporters, you know, just straight up mythology. I mean, nonsense, but there's no accountability.
No accountability. And also, you know, they say something, and several of them say something, reporters now, and then 6 months later, they'll publish a retraction, right? Which is unusual. Now, very often, they don't even bother publishing the retraction. But the reality is, if you have two sources or sources that tell you something, and then it turns out to be not correct, you're then obliged to go back and ask those and interview those sources again and say, why did you get it wrong? Were you lying to me? And if they were lying to you, you almost have an obligation to burn the source, or certainly never use the source again. Or certainly, if you ever use the source again, tell the reader, this is a source that has burned me. You know, but there's none of that. It's like, was this the same source you used for that crap story you did? But there's none of that. There's no accountability. Accountability is a much overused word, but there's no even background or context. I mean, and of course, I know this, and we all know this, because sometimes we're involved in these stories. Mm-hmm. Like, we had the Gosnell screening at the White House, and someone from Politico wanted to do a kind of behind the scenes, how did the Gosnell movie end up at the White House? And I was on a flight, and they were doing the story, and by the time I got off the flight, oh no, I've already filed it. And I read the story, and it was complete nonsense from beginning to end, right? But there was no consequences for it being complete nonsense. In fact, I was so used to it, I didn't even bother making a fuss about it. But it was just, there was nothing factual about it. There was, this meeting was added to that meeting, and somebody was doing this. Just not true. But there was no, the person didn't seem to fear any accountability at all. And Solzhenitsyn was right.
Well, I want to get away from the Solzhenitsyn because we're going to get to other parts of the story. But I do think, and I'm not, you know, I think it's worth mentioning that what happened, and as you probably know, we're making a Hunter Biden movie, but what happened with the New York Post and the Hunter Biden story is instructive. And we're not trying to be political here, but it is interesting, you know, the New York Post had this extraordinary story, put this story out, and then it was suppressed. But on top of that, you actually, just to add to what you just said, journalists were attacking other journalists, right, for reporting.
Cheering the censorship.
They were cheering the censorship. Extraordinary. Anyway,
so to get back to the book, it's very critical of what I think it was C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery.
Oh yeah, this is great.
The idea that scientific advances should have. I mean, maybe I'm. You tell me if I'm understanding this correctly. The idea that scientific advances should affect our moral outlook. That, you know, what has been discovered by the world in the last 10 years or 50 years or 100 years that we didn't know but now know means we should not follow ideas or traditions that were not formed when we were less scientifically advanced. There's many words for it. It's called presentism. I think Mark Stein called it the tyranny of now, and it's kind of the same.
That's good. I like that.
The same thing. It's probably, I mean, am I correct? It's also part of that tearing down statues idea as well. But tell me about the scientific, the chronological snobbery and science.
I was very much a victim of what you would call, what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery or presentism, which was, you know, this sense that when I was an undergraduate, I was a philosophy major, and I couldn't figure out why we were reading Plato in classes or Aristotle, because things came later and that must have been debunked, right? Like now we know about the Big Bang theory and quantum mechanics. So what do Aristotle's views about the unmoved mover or the uncaused cause, what does that have to do with anything? Mm-hmm. It's like a museum piece, who cares? So for a long time, I avoided, you know, kind of serious truths contained in the Western tradition, just based on a kind of bias that the past is a place of darkness and stupidity, and only kind of my own generation or the past few generations have people hit upon important truths. So I was very much a victim of that. And my kind of intellectual evolution and my ultimate coming to the Catholic faith was a kind of revolt against my own chronological snobbery or my own presentism. For C.S. Lewis, he especially took a scientistic shape. I say don't scientific because he was very much, he respected the scientific enterprise as the effort to uncover kind of the secrets of the physical reality using a disciplined method like the scientific method. No problem. The problem begins when we substitute scientific inquiry for all other kinds of inquiry and we apply it to the whole of life so that, questions about, for example, what it means to live a fully human life. What should you do to seek happiness? What should you do when you're faced with certain moral quandaries? These questions don't have scientific answers. They do have right or wrong answers, and those right or wrong answers can be found in our conscience, in the Bible, in the Western tradition, in good poetry and novels. That's where you find those things, but in a certain kind of scientific worldview, they all become kind of provisional, second-rate. Yeah. Now we have quantum mechanics. How is quantum mechanics going to help you when you're faced with, you know, you're an elderly parent is passing away? And you're,
I think you say in the book, or maybe someone, it's like discovering the law of gravity will not help you that.
It won't tell you whether a play is good or not, or whether a movie is good or not. That takes a different kind of judgment. But there's still right or wrong answers to those types of questions too. So the danger is when you reduce all knowledge to facts, you know, things that you can measure with scientific instruments and generally express in mathematical formulae, then everything else, philosophical ideas, metaphysics, religion, become kind of secondary, dubious, as though those things aren't kind of at the same level as science with a capital S, which just speaks univocally in this truth.
Many people would be surprised to hear that you, a Catholic convert who's arguing for the unbroken thread of tradition, quote Andrea Dworkin, the radical feminist, approvingly, and use her views to buttress the idea of the unbroken thread of tradition, and how we should adhere to that unbroken thread regardless of passing fad. So, explain your. How you bring Andrea Dworkin in.
Right, and she probably wouldn't want to be in a book profiled next to like Aquinas and Lewis and Augustine. I think she hit upon something in her diagnosis of sex liberationism as degrading for women. And that was her point. I mean, she championed what was then called anti-pornography feminism. She was very unpleasant about it and she got in your face and she was big, she wore her overalls. But her deeper point was that what people do in the bedroom is inherently public. In other words, how we structure sexuality and how we think about it has public ramifications about the relations between men and women. And she said that sex liberationism had empowered a lot of caddish, horrible men, and that rippled out into the kind of objectification and degradation of women in the rest of society, in the public sphere. And she believed that what men and women do, or what people do in the bedroom, is inherently public. It has ramifications, and if there's a degradation of women and objectification of women going on in the bedroom, it ripples out to how women are treated and framed in a broader public society. So obviously, she said this from a place of radical feminism, and there are many things that she believes that I don't believe in, and she sits oddly with the rest of the characters in the book. Nevertheless, the idea that sex is not private, obviously it's private in the sense that it's deeply intimate and deserves its privacy, but that how it's done and who does it and how has public ramification is also found in St. Augustine's The City of God. In fact, he has a scene in which it's a scene of a Roman groom taking his bride to the bed, kind of marital bedroom for the first time. And he has to have the whole sort of host of polytheistic Roman gods, helping him. Venus holds her down, da, da, da. And Augustine asks, like, why did they need this? And he basically says, because the woman is about to go through something uncomfortable and it's there's an indecent dimension to sexuality. even in a marital setting, that we that should trouble us, and that the there's a possibility of unfair domination or lust for domination that exists inherently in sexuality, which is a result of the fall. And therefore, for Augustine, the private libido dominandi, the lust for domination, had it was a kind of a microcosm of Rome's larger libido dominandi as an empire, which often launched unjust wars. So sex wasn't private. So in that sense, I argue, you can hear my daughter in the background, I apologize. In that sense, I argue that in a narrow way, Andrew Dworkin was an Augustinian traditionalist. Now, they would have completely different ideas about how to deal with that problem.
Yeah, I love that you brought those two together, because kind of like I think you possibly would win the prize as being the only person who's ever done that. And maybe
I draw from the scholarship of a Notre Dame Augustinian thinker named John Cavadini. He's probably kind of the preeminent Augustinian scholar in the United States right now. And so it's his. I'm merely the journalist who brings it to a wider audience.
What does Andrea Dworkin think of, what did she think at the time of being compared to
Augustine?
St. Augustine.
She wasn't, because he wrote his paper, I think, in the early 2000s, something, by the time she was either dying or dead. But she certainly criticized St. Augustine based on a misunderstanding of how he described pre-fall sexuality versus fallen sexuality. But it's a kind of, I go into it into the chapter because it has to do with her, unfortunately, using a kind of bad translation.
I mean, I know we've been talking about different chapters of the book here, and I realize, you know, tell us what you were why you tried to write this book, actually.
Sure.
Maybe, you know, I should have said that at the end.
The bottom line is, that it's the wisdom of limits, that all the pre-modern traditions insisted that that true freedom was actually mastery over the self, it was detachment from all kind of base appetites and so forth, and that you become fully human by accepting various limits imposed on you. And in each of the chapters of the book, I show how the modern demolition of various limits and barriers has paradoxically made us less free, and that those barriers kind of make us free. That's the kind of wisdom that's encapsulated in the subtitle of the book. So, for example, in a chapter on the Sabbath, what looks like a restriction, one day a week where you can't do whatever you want, actually lets you be free of your acquisitiveness and all the sort of clamor and competition of daily life. Or the chapter on the body itself as a limit is worthwhile accepting. Whereas if you treat the body as the ancient Gnostics did and the modern transgender movement does, is the body is just this fleshly apparatus and you're really just a subjective mental being, and you should try to you can reconfigure your body however you want to meet your subjective feelings. Well, that kind of dehumanizes you, because the body itself has a norm, it has a value, and we're embodied beings, so try to transcend the body makes us less fully human. So although the kind of thinkers and times that we kind of explore in the book can seem very disparate, there's this thread through it all, the unbroken thread, in which we see that limits make us free, and the desire to sort of do away with all limits paradoxically makes us
Funny enough, I wish I read your book last week, because I had a conversation with a 13-year-old girl about limits. I was trying to explain to her the value of limits and failing, actually, right? Now, she was actually complaining about her school limiting short skirts and limiting
what girls could wear, but also she was about everywhere limiting what she could wear,
and she felt she was being limited because of what men might do and all that. Now, I mean, she's a very smart and very articulate 13-year-old. In fact, I felt she was more articulate than I was. And I wish I'd read your book. And I might actually send her this podcast, actually, because you've just you've just answered her questions better than I could have. So
good.
Wrapping up, just talking about the book, and then we always have our two additional questions we ask all guests. But and I realize through the podcast, we're hearing your daughter, who's two. So you got a daughter who's two, and you've got your son Max, who's four. And I think my question to you, you know, you talk about the book is, you know, in the book's title ends with the word chaos in a time of chaos, which I think we've no difficulty kind of believing in that we're in a time of chaos. Are you at all hopeful? And what kind of hopeful signs do you see, if you see any?
The hope that I do see, though, is I think, you know, I always say to people who defend the current order, there's a certain kind of conservative that's just very quick to say, well, this, you know, classical liberalism, the best we could do, and there's nothing better that could come. And I always say, just look around, you know, just look around. Things are not good. There's something kind of deeply broken in Western societies. The hope that I have is, I know a lot of younger than me, so I mean, I'm 36. I know a lot of younger thinkers just coming up in their early 20s, mid-20s, typically Catholic, but not exclusively Catholic, who are aware that we can do better, and that we have to recover the West's kind of deeper roots to answer the woke challenge, to build a better society. So it's those young people that give me hope, and being in dialogue with them that keeps me kind of energized.
Okay. The last two questions we ask everyone, then we ask people, if you cook, do you cook, and what do you cook, and what are you famous for in your house?
And what's the recipe?
I cook a lot. Like right now, I'm not, because we're in book launch mode, so I have to excuse myself. But on a normal day, I almost always cook dinner. And I have a repertoire of 4 or 5 things. They're all very basic, but I'm very good at them. Like just a pasta with like vodka sauce and either salmon or kind of sausage in it. I also make a really good burger. My wife attests that it's restaurant quality. Mm-hmm. So they're like kind of man cooking.
Oh yeah, Phelim has an interest in that. So what do you do that makes your burger special?
I toast the buns. And so then therefore they don't bleed into the meat.
Oh yeah, that's very important. Where do you get the meat from?
I get them from Whole Foods, and they're meatballs, but I squish them. Ooh. They're like Parmesan meatballs. So they're very tasty already.
Oh, very good. And then the other question we ask people is a piece of art that's significant and important to them.
Sure. It's a portrait of a kind of very austere looking churchman, but in his kind of full regalia, mm-hmm. of a kind of a Monsignor's regalia, you know, with the cassock and the hat with the little furry thing. I never know what it's called. And Beretta, sorry. And his name is Monsignor A.N. Gilby. He was a priest, a chaplain at Cambridge for many years in the mid 20th century. He was famous for converting a lot of young, intelligent Anglican men to Catholicism. And he himself was an heir to a gin fortune. So he was kind of like, although he was not an aristocrat, he kind of had aristocratic heirs. And he was the spiritual father of the priest who received me into the church.
Who painted that?
It's a Welsh painter named Isabel McWhorter.
Okay.
And she's also in the you know, the British National Portrait Gallery and elsewhere. But she said that he constantly tried to probe her whether like she was socially connected enough for him to know. And then when he found out that she wasn't, then he never spoke to her the rest of the time. So he, in that sense, that's not a very Christian thing to do.
No, no. Very, like, but doesn't it just show
posh Englishman?
Doesn't it just show, you know, this?
But that's a different age, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was famous for saying, like, you think Christianity means one man, one vote? It means nothing of the kind, you know.
Okay, he
sounds true reactionary.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Well, listen, we're going to put up all the information about the book. So you say as well, there is an audible version of the book that you narrated yourself. Yeah, I think that's always a great idea. I narrated our book, and I was very glad I did, actually. So people can get it on Audible, they can get it on Amazon, etc. We're going to put all of that stuff up on the screen here.
Just to remind people, it's called The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom and Tradition. A wisdom of tradition in an age of chaos, and it's by Sohrab Hamari. That's Sohrab and Hamari.
I think it's a great book to read at this particular moment when so many people are very, very troubled by how crazy everything seems to suddenly be. It seems to have happened slowly and then all at once. That the world became chaotic. You know, that's I read something recently where somebody was saying, you know, it's like that thing of how did you lose your money? Slowly at first, and then really quickly at the end. And that's how I describe how things have deteriorated. Sorry. Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Talk to you again.
Pitch me the offense.
Bye-bye. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Well, that was great.
Yes, amazing.
That was really great.
Amazing.
And as I said, we highly recommend the book. I mean, it's kind of the book as well that you could dip in and out of, which is kind of what we did, because we didn't get to read the whole thing over the weekend. But everything that I've read, I've really loved. Yes. And as I said, the stories are really powerful. Highly recommend that. The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos.
Yeah, order it now. It's coming out. It's just come out. Let's get it. Let's order it now and make it a number one bestseller. Let's get it up the bestseller list, because that'll encourage other people to buy it.
What a lovely person.
You know, he's
what
a lovely person. A wonderful person.
He's a great antidote, by the way, to, you know, he's a cure for after thinking or talking about Hunter Biden. He's exactly the opposite of Hunter Biden.
And talking of cure.
Oh, talking of cure. So what happened, Phelan? Did we have an incident?
We had two incidents.
Oh my God, shocking.
Yes. So did we tell people about Top Cat?
Did we tell people about Top Cat?
I don't know.
Magda should know that now. Magda, did we talk about Top Cat?
No. So Top Cat disappeared.
Yes.
We did mention that.
We mentioned Scaredy.
No.
Top Cat disappeared, and then we said, but Scaredy was missing as we were recording.
Actually, yeah. You know what? So as we were recording last week, that's right. Thank you for that, Magda. We said Scaredy Cat was missing, and we were going to update you. Just for everyone who's about to have a heart attack, Scaredy Cat is alive.
Just about. Scaredy came back that evening at 8 p.m. This
Very
is a
late.
Cat who never stays out. And he does stay out against my wishes. Orders, but when he's always at the door the next morning at 7 a.m. or 6
a.m. What happened, Phil?
8 p.m. He walks in, but I look and actually,
can I say that that's a description of
no, but
walks in with
yeah, but we didn't see him limping. He walked in and I grabbed him and brought him over to you,
yeah.
And then you grabbed him and he went and almost bit you,
almost bit me, but he didn't because he's like,
he had this. He had so this massively swollen limb.
Poor
like a
dirt.
Massively
front leg.
Front leg.
Three times the size it should be.
Yes. So it's 8 p.m. We have a cat with a massively swollen limb. And apparently cats can get infected really
easily.
So we decided we would take Scaredy Cat to the vet.
The following day. Not that night, because it's too expensive to do it
that expensive.
Night. And we haven't completely lost the run of ourselves.
We haven't completely gone to the stage where we want to spend large sums of money on our cat. We thought, actually.
We thought.
Yes. So, Scaredy Cat was taken to the vet the next morning.
He was.
And left off there.
Yes.
And then the vet phoned me to tell me what she was thinking of doing. I said, okay, do it.
So, yeah. So we got this message.
Hello, it's Dr. Felix calling from ASIC. He's calling about Scaredy Cat, and as a result, his blood work mainly just showed that he's a little bit stressed here and dehydrated. The x-rays showed no overt evidence of any broken bones. The radiology report is pending. It just shows that his limb is very, very swollen. So at this point, what we're going to do is clean up that little wound on the side of his elbow, and then we're also going to get him started on some pain medications that are also an anti-inflammatory and oral antibiotics. Just give me a phone call here back. I'm typing up some discharges so we can get Scaredy Cat and your assistant heading home. Okay, we'll talk then. Bye.
So there are, I would say, 90% of people who are victims of the free healthcare in Europe, in Ireland and in England, are not as well treated or as quickly treated. I mean, your mother, we took Scaredy up there and he was seen within an hour, seen by appointment. Your mother, she went to
an emergency. I remember her going to the emergency department of a hospital one time and just been there for hours, not being attended. And a friend, we'll leave it nameless just for now, but a friend of ours whose mother was left, you know, just before the pandemic, by the way, and I think she had COVID, by the way, in Dublin, and was left, and only that he put something on Twitter.
Yeah.
She didn't get
what attention. I like was the kind of the seriousness that Scaredy Cat rightly deserves, by the way.
Well, he came home then with his doctor's notes.
Yes, his doctor's notes. This is really his discharge papers. It's very important. And treatment plan, because it's very important to have a treatment
plan.
Don't
forget, this person went to college for like 7 years to become a vet.
Yes. So this is the treatment plan. I'll read you a short section of it. Thank you for bringing Scaredy Cat to the vet for evaluation. Scaredy Cat was presented for evaluation of a swollen right forelimb that was noted today. He was noted to be limping when he came home last night.
Oh.
On presentation.
On presentation. When Scaredy Cat presented.
On presentation today, Scaredy Cat's right forelimb. I love the way the name is like.
And she writes, by the way, Scaredy Cat, capital S, capital C.
Yes. Scaredy Cat's right forelimb was very swollen.
Mm-hmm.
He was uncomfortable on manipulation of this limb.
She manipulated him. Imagine manipulating Scaredy Cat.
But there was no overt instability.
Oh, thank God for no overt instability. We hate that.
He had a small wound.
It's just me that has the overt instability.
Yes.
Move on.
He has a small wound on the outside aspect of his elbow as well.
The outside aspect?
I didn't think of his elbow. By the way, it's not an elbow.
It's not an elbow, but if you were kind of anthropomorphizing the cat, because this is California.
It's a paw.
Move on.
We started by performing blood work.
They performed the blood work on Scaredy Cat.
To assess Scaredy's... This is her writing. We started by performing blood work to assess Scaredy's organ function today.
Very important, by the way. Check out those organs. As I said, most of the population of the planet Earth, by the way, are not getting this medical attention. Move on.
This showed he was dehydrated.
Needed a drink.
I take that as a criticism of us, by the way.
It is a little.
We're not that great at putting water in front of him. This showed he was dehydrated, but otherwise, his kidney and liver function was normal.
Good to check out the kidney and liver function when you've got a cat up there. Right. And lucky, and with us paying for it. Go ahead.
He had x-rays of his right forelimb performed.
X-rays. Yes. Plural.
Our radiologist noted that these images...
The radiologist had to be pulled in. I
wonder how many years at college the radiologist did.
Forever. Go on ahead.
Our radiologist noted that these limbs showed there was no overt orthopedic injuries.
Thank God for no overt orthopedic injuries.
But Scaredy did have significant swelling of his limb.
Oh God, Scaredy. Today we're starting Scaredy Cat on oral what, Phelan?
On oral antibiotics, since we suspect that he has had this extreme swelling from a possible bite wound.
A bite wound.
We are also starting him on an oral non-steroidal anti-inflammatory pain medication for cats.
Not for humans. But non-steroidal.
That'll be in.
By the way, non-steroidal. I love
non-steroidal.
That. Because we wouldn't want him to be getting the steroids.
No, because they'd have cat rage.
He could be developing boobs or something. Go on ahead there.
Or annihilating his family or something. Like
that'd be the type of thing would happen. Go on ahead there now. What else happened? The notes go on for pages. We're only giving you highlights here. Yes. Go on.
Starting him on an oral non-steroidal anti-inflammatory pain medication for cats to help with his pain and generalized swelling of his limb.
Go on ahead.
Please give these medications as directed below. Scaredy should be kept indoors for the next 14 days.
That didn't happen. Can I just say that right now?
While he is recovering from his wound/swelling.
He cried so bitterly on being kept indoors that we didn't have the heart. We kept him in for 3 days. It was torture. Go on ahead.
Scaredy has done well today.
We felt very proud of that, by the way.
We hope he starts feeling better soon.
The whole crowd of them, they're all in sympathy here, you know.
Please call back if you have any questions or concern. And
well, we won't be. Not after we paid your bill, by the way, sweetheart. Yes, we won't be calling you anytime soon.
Then she should have summarised. Diagnosis, right lower forelimb swelling. RO, what's RO?
No idea.
Cellulitis with possible infection. No
cellulitis.
No overt abscess noted.
Very good.
Recheck. Please have Scaredy rechecked if he's not showing signs of improvement in the next few days. And then medications. Amoxiclav, which is the proper name for Clavamox, 60 milligrams.
Enough. Stop already.
Diet. Scaredy Cat resume his normal diet.
Resume his normal diet. Bit of raw
fish. And
then
what at home? If you notice any of these clinical signs or in any way concerned with Scaredy Cat's condition, please call or recheck with a veterinarian right away.
Or a vegetarian.
By the way.
I think I'd prefer to just check with a vegetarian because I have to say, checking with a veterinarian in Los Angeles, if I live to be 1,000, I'll still not recover from the bill we had to pay.
All I can say is thank God my father's dead because if he knew how much I spent on the cat.
It would have been the death of him.
It would have killed him.
And can I just say another thing that I think is curious since we've become cat owners and, you know, we're obviously very young, but when we were growing up in Ireland, I have never heard of a cat getting a drink of water, ever. Now, obviously, we give our cats water now because apparently that's what you're meant to do. In Ireland, they get milk, and that's just about all they get.
Rain.
They're never brought inside. They're never a pet. Not back in the day.
Never
Not
a pet.
Back in the day.
No, they were
because
a farm
the idea
animal.
Was, well, now you lived on a farm. I lived in town. And in town, the cat's purpose was to kill mice and rats. And so they were kept hungry. Kept keen.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically just got they might get a saucer of milk, but that was the height of it. And of course, in this country, whatever kind of country this is, they get not a milk at all. No milk at all. Apparently, that's the worst thing you can ever do. But I do say, I have to say, I will admit that obviously I've become this, like, I'm kind of destroyed by California, because I will admit, and as I said, lucky my parents are dead too, because this would be the death of them. Moving on. Yes. Tell us about Paul Hogan film.
Paul Hogan, Crocodile Dundee.
I didn't know this, by the way.
Lives in Venice, and
Crocodile Dundee.
That's not a knife. This is a knife. Well, Paul Hogan, hell isn't over there. Hell is where he's living right now. He says he's trapped in hell on earth in Venice. His son lives here. He's 81. He'd love to leave, but he can't because his son is in Venice, and he'd love to go back to Australia. But he just, the homelessness and the crime is even annoying and making Crocodile Dundee want to leave. I mean, it's unbelievable. I saw an article in the New York Times that they're saying, you know, the rise in shootings in LA is partially gang related, but it's also shootings at these homeless encampments. And the cops are not allowed to enforce the law and don't want to enforce the law because they'll be charged with murder if it all goes pear-shaped. So
we'll just show you a little short piece of video here of how crazy it is in Venice right now.
Nobody really cares about the city at all. They just let the homeless run wild. It's like the Wild Wild West. They've been lighting things on fire for the last like 6 months. I mean, it's full mayhem down here.
Now at 11, fires, fights, stabbings, shootings. It's the vicious cycle of violence people in Venice have to deal with day in and day out.
The deterioration of Venice Beach continues with this shocking incident. Eyewitness News obtaining this video of a homeless man being shot last week on the Venice boardwalk. The shooter simply walking away. LAPD has no idea who it is or where they may be. This business owner we spoke with called it the Wild West.
They've been lighting things on fire for the last like 6 months. I mean, it's full mayhem down here.
Yeah, you'd hardly believe that, would you?
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. Anyway, we're coming to the end of the show. And I think the last thing that I want to do today, right, Phil?
Is
to do the cocktail. So I went to a friend's house on Friday, Donald, and he made me this very spectacular cocktail. He's decided he's going to start, a lot of people are reinventing the cocktail hour, rediscovering the cocktail hour through the pandemic. And this is called The Last Word. Now, our friend made me the perfect last word. I'm starting with The Last Word, which is a classic Prohibition cocktail. And you'll see me making it right now. And I think what I like about this, and I think I would love to become a mixologist. I think it's very... there's a real alchemy to doing this, and if you do this right, it's really, really gorgeous. So basically, this cocktail, which is called The Last Word, is, you know, equal parts gin, green chartreuse, marasconi liqueur, and lime juice. So there they are. There's the four ingredients, and it's fresh lime juice, by the way. Yes, Phil?
Question.
Yes.
Is there another color of chartreuse?
That's a good question that I don't have the answer to.
Maybe we can check it out.
Well, anyway, so basically you're just going to do that. So it's 3/4 ounce of gin, 3/4 ounce of green chartreuse, 3/4 ounce of maraschino liqueur, and 3/4 ounce of fresh lime juice. Whatever you do, particularly with a cocktail like this, you want this super fresh. Don't use pre-prepared lime juice. And really, you'll get 3/4 ounce of lime out of one good lime. And you want to shake that all about. You're going to throw that into your cocktail shaker with a bunch of ice and give it a good shake, a really good shake for about 20 seconds. You see me shaking it there. Shaky, 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 shaky. Which almost is actually, it's kind of like when I used to smoke cigarettes and the whole process of lighting up a cigarette was so lovely.
And look who's watching.
The uninjured Top Cat. And then you just pour that into your, you know, pre-prepared cocktail glass. You could have chilled that cocktail glass. I didn't. And I just drop into that. A lot of people would drop into that a cherry, but I'm not great on those candied cherries or whatever they call them. But what I put in there instead was a frozen blueberry because I thought that just looked lovely at the bottom of the glass. And I will be honest with you, it's very... it's very, very gorgeous. It's a lovely, it's definitely on the less sweet side. It's definitely on the more tart side, if you like that. Mm. If you're somebody who finds drinks that are too tart, what you can put in there is some simple syrup, a small amount of simple syrup, or a small amount of agave syrup. But I wouldn't like it sweetened. I like it on the bitter side, just to suit my bitter personality. And I just think really, really, really great. As I said, very popular during Prohibition. Fell out of favor after World War II and recently arrived in Seattle and has become kind of a very celebrated cocktail all over the country now. Mm-hmm. So it's called The Last Word, and I really would recommend. Now, Phelan wants to tell his story. What do you tell?
Yeah, well, so We got a. This is, shows you the power of marketing. We got a brochure through our in our door box and our letterbox saying it's Bloomingdale's, and you can, if you order this Villeroy and Bosch dinner set and glasses or dinner set, you get 60%. Everything was 60% off. And if you see in our kitchen, sometimes when we're doing cooking, you can see the plates. They're a bit mixy matchy.
And they're not alone. Are they mixy matchy? They're all chipped.
A lot of them are chipped. And we, as you know, we do a lot of socializing.
That's where they're chipped.
And we have a lot of people over. We have a lot of dinner parties. And you know, it was getting to the stage where I was trying to find the non-chipped plates to give to people.
Yes.
And cups, etc. So I says, well, 60% off Villeroy and Bosch, right?
Gotta do it.
So we went on, and there it was. Suddenly it had dropped to 38 when you got online, and I said, we're not doing that. However, I took an executive decision and ordered it anyway. And I, as a sort of side order, I ordered, on a separate order, I ordered glasses as well.
Because to kind of cheer me up.
Yeah, because Anne likes nice glasses.
And I like nice glasses. And the thing about these glasses that we got, which is great, they're stemless.
Yeah,
so you can put them in the dishwasher. They're really nice.
I think I got 12 or 16 of those glasses.
Moving
different
on.
Types.
What happened then?
So the dinner set came, and there was six salad plates, six dinner plates, six bowls, six cups, six saucers. I mean, it was lovely. But anyway, I was opening it out of the box, and there was one big plate and one small plate smashed.
Broken.
Right? So I wrote to Bloomingdale's, and I said, look, two of the plates, and I took pictures. Here are the two plates broken. Can you send me replacements? And they said, no, we can't. I said, oh? And he says, our policy is to replace the whole order.
The whole order?
And I says, hold on, all I want is two plates. I don't want the whole order. Like, and he says, no, we have to send you the whole order. And I was going, you're sending me a whole new, which is quite good, because
it was
six plates, six of everything, and we often have eight people. So it was actually nice. We're now going to have 12 of everything, which is great.
We'll have more than 12. Yeah, we'll have 12 of everything. Actually, no, because it's two that broke. We'll have 10 of everything.
Yeah, so then that I looked at the order, well, they confirmed the order. Not only are they sending me new plates and new dinner set, they're sending me a complete new order of the glasses as well.
Party time over here.
So,
very good.
And we're not sponsored by Bloomingdale's, but we should be.
Very impressed, by the way. This is very typical, by the way, of American, service in shops. It's like, it's amazing that they do this kind of thing. That's why people are loyal. It'll make you very loyal. You want to go back again. It's like Costco. Costco takes stuff back no matter what. And because of that, people are very loyal I wonder how many people abuse it. Funny, I would never abuse it, but it's lovely to know. It's lovely to know that you can bring things back.
You could run a business out of that. You could just order Villeroy and Bosch.
Well, no, it'd be terrible thing. God bless
us. I know, but it's like, it's an amazing, they're sending me all. Anyway, it's wonderful.
They were delighted.
We're going to have, our table is going to look very nice for a while.
For a while. Yeah. He's presuming already we're going to break them.
Yeah, well, they do get heavy wear and tear.
That's enough for this week. So we will see you next week. And don't forget, mysonhunter.com. Give what you can. And we'll have updates coming very soon.
Meow.